Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go. It's the American Sports History Podcast, and man, this show, you guys have made it what it is today. It's just picking up steam. I am so blessed to produce it. A brother, a mentor, and a friend, Peter Ray, out there in Cleveland, Ohio, running it. 347-205-9631. Catch the archive version, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcast, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, let me lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic, and before I do, a couple guys, Dalen from Chelmsford, Peter, says, the Browns, what happened to them? And Joe from Flint, Michigan, says Dan Campbell for president. Oh, my gosh. On that note, I'll turn it over to you, Peter. How are you? How can people get a hold of you? And you're bringing your great monthly guest in here.
Hi, Mark. I'm doing well. I have a YouTube channel. It's my name, Peter J. Rea. You're absolutely right. Tonight's our NFL history night. We have the author of four tremendous sports books, Bench Bosses, the NHL's Coaching Elite 2015, Art of the Dealers, the NHL's Greatest General Managers 2017, Lords of the Gridiron, College Football's Greatest Coaches 2019, and the book we talk about every once a month, Lords of the Gridiron 2, Pro Football's Greatest Coaches 2022. I'm really looking forward to his next two books, which will come out in 2026, Baseball's Greatest Managers and the NBA's Greatest Coaches. Welcome to the show, Mr. Matthew DiBiase.
Peter, Mark, it's so great to be back, man. It's got a little bit of snow. We had a little bit of snow last night and this morning, you know, here in Philadelphia. First time in 2 years, man. It's kind of a weird feeling getting used to snow again, man. A quote-unquote normal winter, as it were, and all that. But I'm doing fine. I'm feeling warm, and I'm feeling good, and I'm raring to go.
Yeah, it's we're making our way through your book, the top 50 coaches in NFL history. Tonight we're up to, we'll do 34 and 35, starting with 34, Buddy Parker.
Wow, Buddy Parker, a name obscured by history, but I'll tell you, for his time, he was a great coach. I mean, it's ironic that Detroit Lions finally won their first playoff game in like 30-some years, because Buddy Parker, in the 1950s, the Lions, people don't realize this, the Lions were one great football team in the 1950s, and one of the reasons why they were a great football team was because Buddy Parker was coaching them. He was the second greatest coach of the 1950s after Paul Brown, according to my rating system in my book. He led the Detroit Lions to two NFL titles. This is pre-Super Bowl era. This is when they still had, they just called it the NFL championship game. Back-to-back titles in 52 and 53. He actually led them to three consecutive NFL championship game appearances from 52 to 54. He was the only man ever to beat Paul Brown twice an NFL championship game competition, went at 2 out of 3 falls in 52 and 53. I mean, he basically had Paul Brown's number for the most part. He was also an incredibly innovative coach in two things. One, it was under Buddy Parker that what we take for granted today, the two-minute offense, was really, it was developed by him. No one had ever came up with that concept before, but it was Parker who really articulated, created a set system for conducting a two-minute offense, then unleashed it upon the NFL. And another one of his innovations was the idea of basically drafting top elite athletes for your offense, whereas before, your defense basically consisted of your offensive cast-offs, as it were. Though mostly it was like two-way players, but then when you start having separate squads, your best players were on offense, not on defense, but Parker reversed that. He was actually drafting elite athletes to play defense exclusively, and also in the defensive secondary. He had one of the best defensive secondaries during his glory years with the Detroit Lions in the early to mid-50s there. And then after he left the Lions, before the arrival of Chuck Knoll, Bill Cowher, and Mike Tomlin, it was Buddy Parker who was the greatest coach in Pittsburgh Steelers history. And he came very, very close to leading the Steelers to their first NFL championship game appearance in 1963, only to fall short, but no one had ever come that close before. I mean, he tried his very best and all that. But his story is this. It's ironic, even though he made his name in Detroit, actually he was from Texas. He was born and raised in the greater Dallas area, went to college North Texas University. He wanted to play pro football, and he was basically selected by the Detroit Lions, for whom he later coached. He was a part of their 1935 NFL championship team. He was part of their backfield there. He was a blocking back. And then once his playing career ended, he went immediately into coaching, and he worked for a long time with what were then called the Chicago Cardinals, now today the Arizona Cardinals. But back then they began in Chicago before they moved to St. Louis and then eventually to Arizona. And he was an assistant coach under a variety of guys, Jimmy Konsolman and then Phil Handler. And then when Jimmy Konsolman came back after the war, he was instrumental. He was like a line coach, and he was instrumental in the Cardinals appearing in back-to-back NFL championship games in 1947 and 1948, and they won the 47 title there. And then when Jimmy Konsolman retired after 1948, Buddy Parker, along with Phil Handler, were co-head coaches. They're two men. They're literally, they were co-coaching together. But it was an arrangement that only lasted a very brief time. I think it was only like two games into the 1949 season, and then he just abruptly quit. And that was another aspect of Buddy Parker. Parker was he had his little quirks, little eccentricities. I mean, he was very impulsive, and if he felt like someone was interfering or he didn't feel comfortable, he would just up and leave. I mean, he did that several times throughout his coaching career. I mean, he upped and left the Cardinals, and down the road, he shockingly left the Detroit Lions, which we'll talk about later. But he was very much a creature of impulses, also very superstitious. Like, I remember reading while I was doing my research on him, he would not stay in a hotel room where the numbers, when you added them together, became the number 13. No, wouldn't do that. No, wouldn't do that at all. Here's another thing. Great Pittsburgh Steelers linebacker Andy Russell had this thing. Like, his starting lineups, if he won a game with a certain starting lineup, he wouldn't change it. And that's one reason why Andy Russell, who was a rookie in 1963, got significant playing time in 1963, even though he was a raw rookie, because he happened to be in the lineup when the Steelers won a whole bunch of games, and Parker left him there. And Russell said what's ironic is that there were a couple of times he made some mistakes that actually hurt the team, but Parker kept him in there, and, you know, he stuck it out for the rest of the season. I mean, very superstitious, very, very superstitious. But he was good, though. He was brilliant with the X's and O's. And after he left the Cardinals, he became an assistant coach with the Detroit Lions under Bo McMillan. And the Lions had a very good, talented team. I mean, they had players. They had Bobby Lane. They had Doak Walker, Cloyce Box, Jim Doran, Lou Creekmore, you know, Harley Sewell. I mean, these were great players, right? But they were underachieving under McMillan, and the Lions ownership was asking the players, what the heck is going on? And basically they just said, we're not going to make it under McMillan. He said, if you put Buddy Parker as head coach, we can win, and that's exactly what happened. Bo McMillan was replaced, and Buddy Parker took over in 1951. And in his first season, they lost late in the season, and it cost them a shot at winning the Western Conference title. But and then from 52 to 54, they dominated the Western Conference there. And you had, again, great players there. You had Bobby Lane. Though if you look at his individual stats, they weren't exactly that impressive, but what a leader on the field. I mean, he was just like a coach on the field. He was such a fiery, inspirational presence, and he was a genius with the two-minute offense. I mean, he could just navigate his teams in only a short amount of time. He could just move them down the field. I mean, at first it was like a trick. You know, Parker just wanted to experiment. Let's see how many plays a team can get off in 2 minutes or less. And they showed like, ooh, wow, yeah, I realize you can get that many plays. So Parker started experimenting. He would call out a certain time in a certain situation. Okay, you only have a minute 53 and only two timeouts. See how many plays you can get off. Then he would change it. Okay, a minute 12 and only one timeout. And again, emphasis was getting as many plays off as possible. And then it became a part of their arsenal. And one great example of how that two-minute offense was brilliant was in the 1953 NFL Championship game against the Cleveland Browns. The Lions defense held Otto Graham to only two completions out of 15 attempts, and yet despite it was the worst game that Otto Graham ever played as the Browns quarterback. But the thing is, even though the defense at Cutley completely shut down Otto Graham, the Lions were still losing 16-10 thanks to Lou Groza's field goal kicking. And finally, the Lions get the ball. I forget where. Deep in their own territory, and it's almost like two minutes and change left. And Bobby Lane just starts moving them right down that field. I mean, he's just navigating, using the clock brilliantly. And it took in six plays, three times he hits end Jim Doran with key passes that get him to the Cleveland Browns 33. Finally, it's coming down to it, and they have a little call timeout, and they have a little conference, and Buddy Parker wanted to use one play, but Jim Doran and Bobby Lane told Buddy Parker, no, we can fake to the inside and then, just go on a fly pattern. Let's do it that way, because they're fearing the inside route. And Buddy Parker said, okay, go ahead and do it. And Bobby Lane sent a man in motion just to draw the linebacker off, just to occupy him. And then Doran did it. He did a great faked an inside move, and then he just burned it down the sideline, went 33 yards into the end zone. Bobby Lane hit him with a touchdown pass, and Doak Walker kicked the extra point, and the Detroit Lions won the game 17-16. And it's kind of and it's sort of an irony. That 53 Lions team was the last all-white team ever to win an NFL championship title. Seriously, yeah, the last all-white team ever to do that. And it's kind of a mystery why Buddy Parker isn't in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, because all this pre-Super Bowl era coaches, those coaches who won at least two or more titles, they all got inducted in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, but Buddy Parker still isn't inducted. And the question is why, and I think one reason why is that Parker was not really friendly towards African-American football players. I mean, when he took over the Lions in 51, there were like two or three of them, but as time passed, he got rid of all of them. And by 53, the Lions were an all-white team, which is kind of ironic because, Detroit, Michigan has a very substantial and thriving, African-American community, but no. This Lions team was all white. And then later on, when he went to Pittsburgh, again, he really did not get along well with the African-American players. I mean, Dan Rooney talked about it. He said a couple of times he had to put out some fires because Parker would kind of get into his cups and make some insensitive remarks. And just it led to consternation. So one wonders if that's one key reason why Parker just hasn't been inducted into the Hall of Fame. That could be a reason for it. That's one possible suggestion. But, the thing was, he was a great coach. And then after 53, they won the title. They were in the NFL championship game in 54, but they were totally blown out by Cleveland. They lost 56-10. And then in 55 and 56, the Lions fell short. First the Rams beat them out, and then the Bears beat them out in 56. And by this time, the Lions had brand new ownership, but it was like this big committee. It's like the old story, too many cooks spoiling the pot. And these new owners were kind of interfering with Parker, and it was like a burr in a saddle. And then finally in the 57 preseason at a booster meeting, he gets up and he just says, I'm leaving this team. I can't take it anymore. I can't win with these guys. I mean, it was a shock. I mean, it was absolute shock. And he quit, and right then and there, Art Rooney Sr. seized the opportunity and hired Buddy Parker to take over the Pittsburgh Steelers. And Parker did so. And it's interesting, people talk about George Allen with his over-the-hill gang, trading away youngsters and draft choices for veteran players. Guess what? Buddy Parker did that before. I mean, he did it before George Allen did, because that was part of his rebuilding effort. Getting rid of, your draft choices and raw rookies and just bringing in veteran players from all over the NFL. He vowed Steelers were getting the championship game in five seasons, but it took seven. But the thing is, they didn't make it a championship game, but it's finding the seventh season there in 63. The Steelers made a significant run. And by going into week 14, the last game of the season, if Pittsburgh had been able to beat the Giants in the last game of the season, they would have won the Eastern Conference title and played in the 63 NFL championship game against the Bears on percentage points, because back then they didn't count ties like they do now. A tie now is like half a win and half a loss. Back then, ties didn't count. So mathematically, they would have won the Eastern Conference title, but sadly, Pittsburgh got beaten 33-17, and it wouldn't be till Chuck Knoll came along that finally the Steelers would get into the Super Bowl and win an NFL championship and all of that. And the following season, Pittsburgh went straight down the tubes. Party Parker was drinking, and then when he wanted to make a controversial trade, Dan Rooney, Steelers president Dan Rooney, stopped him, and in a rage, Buddy Parker quit right then and there and never coached in the NFL ever again.
Yeah, this is a good guy to talk. I mean, I don't think I'd ever heard of Buddy Parker, and it's good, glad to hear about him. And like you said, he deserves some attention because for his accomplishments, beating Paul Brown a couple times. You mentioned that of the 22 Lions in the Hall of Fame, seven were involved with him.
Yeah,
and definitely. This is good Detroit Lions history, and here they're in the playoffs. And by the way, I'm rooting for the Lions and Bills to go to the Super Bowl. And if either one won it all, that would be great. Now, you mentioned in the book also how, as a player, the 1935 championship, NFL championship game, he played a major role, rushed for 70 yards. Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you talked about Bobby Lane's his conviviality, camaraderie, and how he may have not been the prettiest quarterback in the NFL in terms of aesthetic style, but he was a natural-born winner and brilliant in stealing victory from the jaws of defeat. So that's good. We're getting into Bobby Lane. He deserves some attention, too. What a character long before our time. Let's see. Let's wrap this up before we move on. And, yeah, what – Otto Graham, 2-for-15. Wow, that's something, a championship game. So this is really good history. Now let's move on to 35, Mike Shanahan.
Wow, Mike Shanahan. Probably the greatest coach in Denver Broncos history, winner of their first two Super Bowl triumphs there after a long history of frustration, of four humiliating Super Bowl losses. He's the one who turned it around. I mean, I remember that, you know, that Super Bowl in 97 and 98, you know, the Super Bowl there where he beat the Packers and then later beat the Falcons. I mean, for 14 consecutive years, the AFC was losing to the NFC in the Super Bowl there. I mean, it was just one mostly humiliating losses, not seldom, if ever, were close margins whatsoever. And yet Shanahan, thanks to, you know, Terrell Davis and John Elway in the twilight of his career, finally they put it all together. He was a great coach, a great offensive coach there. Was born in Oak Park, Illinois, which is a Chicago suburb there. And he was a record-setting quarterback for his high school football team. But he never got to play in a major university. He was playing in Eastern Illinois. And the thing is, he almost got killed in a game there. He got tackled so hard. After the game, he was urinating blood, but he didn't think much of it. And then all of a sudden, you know, he just kind of collapsed, and he was taken to the hospital. And what happened is that he had a punctured kidney. Yeah, by the hit, he almost died. In fact, they had a priest there administer the last rites, but somehow he pulled through. But they told Pat Mike Shanahan, "You can never play football again." But what happened was that instead of playing football, he built his body up, you playing other sports and all that. But he took up coaching immediately, and he became a very brilliant offensive coordinator. First, he worked as an assistant under Barry Switzer in Oklahoma during those glory years from the 70s and all that. Then he did two seasons as a running backs coach at Northern Arizona. Then he finally got his first offensive coordinator job at the University of Minnesota, and then he went to Florida. And he really was instrumental in reviving the Florida Gators football program from 80 to 83 there. He was just, he worked under Charlie Pell. And the Gators were like 0-10-1 in 79. But then, you know, the next four seasons, they went 32-15-1 and led them to four minor bowl game appearances and two bowl game wins. And that's when the NFL started noticing this guy. I mean, this guy is like an offensive wizard here. You know, let's see what he can do in the pros. And it was Dan Reeves who tapped him because Reeves, he had been coached for a while. I mean, he needed someone to revive the Broncos offense because they weren't really doing that well. And Craig Morton was getting old. And finally, in 83, they draft this stud quarterback named John Elway. And they needed a quarterback whisperer to, bring out the genius in Elway. And that was Mike Shanahan. I mean, those two just formed an incredible relationship. And it was Elway who told, Shanahan who told Elway to begin a weightlifting regimen. And that's why, Elway was always so tough and sturdy because, he built up his body, hit that weight room. He could take the buffeting and pounding. That's why he was able to endure for all those years. He livened up the Broncos offense. And that kind of led him in conflict with Dan Reeves. The sad part about it was that it was like an unholy relationship between Dan Reeves, Shanahan, and Elway, because Reeves was very conservative-minded because he came out of Dallas and, he was still trying to use that multiple offense like Landry was using, but it was just too conservative, and Shanahan wanted to liven things up, and so did Elway. I mean, Shanahan wanted to use Elway's enormous throwing skills and really, stretch it out, go deep, be more daring and all that. And Reeves and Elway never really got along. And basically what happened is that Shanahan became the man in the middle. He was trying to satisfy both men, both Reeves and Elway. And it's very difficult there. And it was always an uneasy relationship. And, sometimes Elway would say something to spoil the pot, and that more often than not it was Reeves who was spoiling the pot. And then you had a brand new owner, Pat Bowlen, who took over the team. And Bowlen had he was having this strange relationship. Like he would invite Elway and Shanahan over for wine drinking, at the Bowlen home there with his wife and all that. But he would never invite Reeves. So it was like a weird little thing, little. I don't know if you call it Machiavellian, but it was like a lot of back-channel relationships there. Like the left hand not knowing what the right hand's doing, the left foot not knowing what the right foot is doing. And it was all building up, and then finally with Reeves losing those Super Bowls, those three Super Bowls, he was basically wearing out his welcome. And Shanahan wanted out of the situation, and for a time he left Denver. And he went over to San Francisco, and that really broadened his horizons. Even though he worked under Dan Reeves, actually you could say Shanahan was a part of the Bill Walsh, George Seifert coaching tree there, because Walsh was there as GM and Seifert was there as head coach. And when Mike Holmgren left San Francisco to take over as head coach of the Packers, Shanahan took his place. And he was exposed to the 49ers system of excellence, where they're winning all these Super Bowls. They're really dominating the NFC there. It's not just enough to win. You have to make sure you're executing their plays and patterns perfectly. In other words, you're doing things the right way there. And he was being exposed to this. And when it came time for him to return back to Denver, he brought that mindset with him. In other words, it's not enough that you got yardage on the play. Did you really execute your patterns perfectly? And he was more demanding now. Even his relationship with Elway changed, because now as head coach, he can no longer be Elway's buddy. So what he had was he had Ted Kubiak do what Shanahan did before when he was an offensive corner, be the good guy, be the quarterback whisperer. And that's how Ted Kubiak got his start. And later he became head coach at Denver and helped them win a Super Bowl title. So he wanted to make sure that Denver was a total package, because before, during the late 70s and mid to late 80s, when they were losing the Super Bowls, they never had all the pieces. They may have the offense, but they never really had the defense. They never really had a ground game. Now Denver was going to be a complete total package. you already had the passing with John Elway, but now with Terrell Davis, now you had that killer running back, which Denver hadn't had since the days of Floyd Little, balancing out the offense. You had a great receiving core. Also, you're building up the defense. You're getting Bill Romanowski. You're getting a whole bunch of other guys. You're getting good, solid defense. And from 97 to 98, they just dominated the AFC there. And they took on, the Packers. And was it Super Bowl 32? I think it was at Super Bowl 32 or something like that. Yeah, 32, 33. And I mean, it was a stalemate on halftime, and then in that second half, Terrell Davis just starts grinding him through, and they're gaining yardage, and they start putting points together, and they win. Finally, they win. Thank God. I remember I was ecstatic that day. I was so sick and tired of watching the NFC dominate. It was great to see the Denver Broncos, you know, put it together and finally break their playoff curse there, and then the following season they do it again, and ironically they take on the Atlanta Falcons, coached by another Dan Reeves. And going into the Super Bowl matchup, Dan Reeves made a big mistake. He kept bringing up all the nonsense, you know, the nonsense between him and Shanahan and Elway, all the garbage and all that. And that was a great psychological spur for Elway and Shanahan. And in the game, you know, it was kind of semi-close, and then Elway threw that great big touchdown. It was his last great touchdown pass, and it broke the game wide open, that bomb route, and it worked. And then, again, back-to-back titles. I mean, Mike Shanahan joins that exclusive club of coaches who won consecutive Super Bowls. But then after that Super Bowl triumph, he was never able to reach those heights again. John Elway retires right after that Super Bowl game. And finally, you know, in 08, he leaves. And then he tries to get it all back with the Washington Redskins from 2010 to 2013. But this is under Dan Snyder. And every coach who coached under Dan Snyder just got it. It was the Snyder curse. They couldn't get it going. And actually, Shanahan lost some points due to that stint there. He probably would have earned higher than 35th had he not taken the Redskins job. And then finally, after 2013, he steps down and is not, you know, not yet returned to NFL coaching. His son Kyle is coaching the San Francisco 49ers, and if the 49ers ever win the Super Bowl title under Kyle, they'll become the first father and son coaching combo ever to do so.
Yeah, the Mike Shanahan. I like this part in your book. You mentioned how he, after Denver won a game, Shannon Sharp had 180 receiving yards, and Shanahan criticized him for mistakes made in the game. And then, and he coached Robert Griffin III, RG3, which was a real big deal at the time. His career really didn't take off. And then with Elway winning that was the cool play when Elway did running play, and he helicoptered for the first down. And then now, like you said, his son Kyle is – got the Niners as the one seed in the NFC. So that's and I remember watching a game when it was late, and I don't know who he was coaching, but late in the game, down one, and he went for 2 points on a touchdown. And it was like, whoa, I'd never seen anything like that before, because he got it. So they won. He didn't want to go for the tie and go into overtime. What a brave move. That's tremendous. Our guest tonight has been Matthew DiBiase. We've been talking about his wonderful book, Lords of the Gridiron 2, Pro Football's Greatest Coaches 2022. Matthew, the time has run out. Do you have any final words for our audience?
Yeah, my book, Lords of the Gridiron 2, is still on sale at 30% off and will remain on sale at 30% off until after this upcoming Super Bowl is played. So if you want to get it at 30% off, go out and get it. It's on Amazon. Just type in Lords of the Gridiron 2, Pro Football's Greatest Coaches, or my name, Matthew DiBiase, DiBiase, and there it is. So go out and get it, folks.
Thanks so much for a wonderful another show on NFL history, Matthew. It's just, I always enjoy it. And here, this is great for Detroit Lions fans especially and Denver Broncos fans. So thanks so much for coming on. Wonderful show again tonight.
Take care, Peter. Stay warm, man.
Okay, very good. We're going to have 4 weeks from tonight, we'll have Matthew DiBiase back, February 13th. We'll talk about Jimmy Conzelman, who coached from 1921 to 1948, won NFL titles with the Providence Steamroller and Chicago Cardinals, and Sean McVay, who's been the LA Rams coach since 2017, won a Super Bowl recently. Next week we're going to have Bill North, a tremendous MLB center fielder in the 1970s. In 2 weeks we'll have Jeff Fry, an MLB player from 1992 to 2001. Dear listener, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Good night, everybody. Thanks again so much, Mr. Matthew DiBiase.
Take care, Peter. God bless you all.
God bless you.
Okay.